Good evening and welcome to Radio Edutalk. My name is Dave Noble in Dalgety Bay and I'm delighted to welcome to the show this evening Dr. Laura Colucci-Gray, who is a lecturer in Science and Sustainability Education and is Director of Postgraduate Research Degrees in the School of Education at the University of Aberdeen. And this evening we're going to be talking around the subject, Is Scotland Going to Feed the World? Welcome to the show, Laura.
Good evening, David.
And I wonder...
Hello. It's great
to have you join us tonight, Laura, and thank you for giving up your valuable time. I'm just wondering if we could start off maybe with a little bit of background to your career in academia and education.
Sure. As you said, I'm currently actually a senior lecturer in the School of Education, so I had a good news this year about a small change.
Right, congratulations.
Track, yes. I actually have a background in natural sciences. I'm originally from Italy. I gained my first degree at the University of Turin. And when I reached my fourth year, I just couldn't do with a career in science, and I got really interested in science education, and particularly issues of science in society. I came across at the time an interesting issue that was to do with intensive prawn farming in India. It caused a huge debate and it seemed really quite relevant to my degree, but it was beyond, it kind of exceeded the capacity of my degree. It required something else, and that's how I became interested in education. And I thought, how can we sensitize the public to issues of this kind, and how can we bring these issues into schools? What kind of approaches do we need to develop? So that really where my career started off, and my study began with a master's and a PhD, which I then obtained in the United Kingdom at the time, and it was a PhD in science education. And I looked at role-play methodologies and other participatory methodologies to get children to talk around controversial issues, ask questions, debate, and trying to find consensus. So as many people in academia know, we have a long period of being contract researchers, contract lecturers. So I worked at the University of Turin, the University of Aosta in Italy, the University of Strathclyde, and then I landed in Aberdeen, where I am to this time. So in short, what happened.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much. And as I say, we're going to talk about around the question, is Scotland going to feed the world? And we've kind of labelled this a critical interrogation of salmon farming and GM technology. And as I've admitted to you, Laura, it's not really my area, but as I'm teaching a little bit of modern studies this academic year, I've found the kind of my reading around tonight's topic very interesting. You've posed a couple of kind of reflective questions for listeners if they're interested, and I'll just say in a moment how they might be able to get in touch with you either during the live show or in the coming days. But firstly, your questions to listeners: how do we assess safety in GM salmon farming? What are the expectations that farming of GM salmon seek to meet and satisfy? How do we make decisions, and whose voices are taken into account? And if you've got comments or questions for Laura in the next 25 minutes or so, or as I say, in the days and weeks after the live broadcast, I'm sure you can contact Laura direct at the university. But you can also get in touch in two ways with the show. You can email edutalker, that's edutalkr @hotmail.co.uk, or if you're on Twitter, you can include the hashtag edutalk in with your comment or question. So can you just provide a bit of kind of context around this issue in terms of the kind of writings that you've been interested in, what you've been interested in that have continued, I suppose, to problematise GM salmon farming?
Sure. Yes, as I said to you, when I first started looking into this issue, actually it wasn't to do with salmon, but it was to do with fish farming. As I mentioned, it was prawn farming at the time. It was a big issue that we're talking in. It goes the year 1995, when I first approached the issue of fish farming, and particularly prawns. In aquaculture ponds, the issue became fairly huge and sensitive in and around tropical countries. At the time, it felt like a faraway issue, even although we were at the beginning of what we come to be known as globalization, and prawns were kind of appearing on our tables frequently. So there were links, obviously, between the faraway context of the tropics and the local context of our Saturday night curry. But still quite far. And at the time, an interesting article appeared in Science by a group of researchers. The first one was a Naylor. And they began to sort of raise questions about the suitability of considering aquaculture of prawns as being an effective way of providing food for the world. As you might know, prawns are carnivores and they feed at the top of the food chain. Therefore, it's quite expensive to raise them. In fact, they would be fed cereals, they would be fed bycatches of fish. So these researchers were sort of really querying the fact that we would be using what would be suitable food for humans and other populations to actually produce another product or a new product. Now, this is from an economic point of view. And questions were also being raised about aquaculture of cod and aquaculture of salmon. At the time, were kind of exploratory studies, but unsurprisingly, I would say, in 2010, another article appeared in Science, signed by Martin Smith, in which they were asking the questions of whether or not genetically modified salmon is safe to eat. So this is quite an interesting jump. I thought, oh, in 1995, they were asking whether or not we should actually raise prawns at all. And in 2010, we kind of moved beyond those original questions, and we went into not only raise, let's say, wild salmon in aquaculture ponds, but create a completely new species of salmon and raise it in aquaculture ponds. So it seemed to me that while the consumers ourselves were busy with our everyday activities, scientific researchers were taking a particularly interesting and possibly quite risky path. So that's what spurred my interest in looking into it a bit more and wondering how did we come to this point? So what sort of policy questions are driving research priorities such as that of developing GM salmon.
Yeah, and I'll just say at this point, Laura, that if you go to the EduTalk Twitter account, or indeed to the EduTalk homepage, there's a link to just a easily downloadable Word document that just has these questions that you've posed as just at the top of the show, plus some of the links that you're going to mention, including the article in the Science magazine, which I know there's a paywall, but all the links that you'll be mentioning will be available on that document. I was really interested in the Science article about just how the market for salmon had altered in the last kind of 30 years or so.
Yeah.
And also that possibly the laws hadn't kept up, and so I don't know how really to term it, Laura, but there seemed to be a kind of gap between the ethical behaviours within the market that were probably required from an environmental point of view and the laws that were in place or were developing at the time.
Absolutely. This is really put the finger on the plague here. As the scientific research progresses, and as I said, a new species of salmon is essentially a new product, something that biologically we don't really know how it works. I mean, we know perhaps the specifics of the physiology of the organism. We might know something about its behavior in controlled environments, but we don't know how it would relate to other species. We don't know how it would fed if it wasn't kept in a safety pen and if it was in the wild. We don't know what kind of interbreeding phenomena might occur. We don't know resistance to parasites or resistance to climate, because essentially something completely new that has been brought into the ecological web, essentially, into the ecosystem. So it's very difficult to regulate because the laws go by phenomena that have already occurred or for which we have some knowledge of. So the law will inevitably be behind. It's not one step, two steps with respect to what might happen, what might occur. So it's like catching up constantly, and it's very hard to make decisions on what we used to refer to as solid evidence base, because this type of evidence is gathered as we go along. Hence why it seems to me that different kind of approach to making decisions is needed. It doesn't simply look at the numbers, but it look at other aspects such as the values and experiences that people have had in the past, fishermen, for example. And I also included, and say this for the audience, some articles that refer to the movements that are actually growing around the world led by Aboriginal First Nations populations, such as the one in Australia and British Columbia. People that have had a long history of close contact with salmon populations that know very well the path the salmon takes and the way in which salmons interact with changes in the ecosystems, and they argue very much for trying to reinstate white salmon populations rather than going for something that yet we don't know what might do. However, it's not that simple, as you can imagine, because the economic interests, as you said, are really high. In fact, aquacultural prawn and salmon is on the rise, is on the growth. It's a huge agri-farming business, and this is where Scotland comes in. Because, yeah. of course, it's one of the probably most productive activities that are currently taking place, for which we don't know very much, even if they're just around the corner from us.
And the main arguments then, which I think some of the articles, although they seem to be very clear that there may be unintended consequences from our current actions, and I suppose one of the other things is that where the laws are located. I mean, one of the things that struck me in the articles we're talking about, it was a call for the federal agencies in the United States to get their act together and to be maybe more risk averse, for want of a better phrase, but also because of the transatlantic kind of nature of the markets and the ecology, that other countries should surely be, you know, part of the forums that are involved in taking forward the kind of new laws and regulations, if there are to be any.
Absolutely. How do we regulate? As I said, it is extremely problematic, particularly the United States. I don't know whether you have heard that recently there was a declaration in the news saying that the United States are no longer a democracy, as if we didn't know already. But with respect to the influence that private interests are having on policy decisions, we're talking about mechanisms called as the revolving door, whereby representatives of multinational companies are appointed to sit on the boards of agencies such as the food standard agencies, and they bring obviously the interests of the companies they used to be working for or still working for in one way or another. So there's a clear closed loop that makes it very difficult, not simply to address what the real risk might be, but even to question what the agenda is in the first place. As I said, we're talking about GM salmon. So my original questions to this debate is, what are the expectations? So why are we determined to pursue this particular line of economic development? Who's asking for it? What is the real issue underneath? This is really what I'd like to stimulate the audience to talk about. Is it really an issue of food scarcity, or is it mainly an issue of profit? because clearly salmon is a very profitable type of food. It's sold in the supermarkets as being one of now basically ubiquitous ubiquitous fish that you could you could find. And if you notice, it seems to me that the variety of fish available on the shelves has decreased rather than increased. If you go into Sainsbury's or Asda, all you can find is salmon and prawns, which is basically dominating the market.
I don't want to put words into people's mouths, but I would imagine that some of the arguments go along the lines of because salmon's got the highest levels of omega-3 fatty acids, that it's better that people and possibly people from low-income households are eating that instead of other protein sources. But I assume that you don't buy that as being the main driver worldwide for the industry.
Well, certainly in the article by Smith et al, that is one of the points that's been made. So they are balancing out the requirement for the American populations in particular, because they're referring to the context of the US, requirements for a better diet, for a healthier diet, requirements for increase the life expectancy of citizens in the United States. Therefore, we have to increase the input of omega-3 fatty acids. On the other hand, they are asking whether or not this requirement can be justified by increasing the production of GM salmon. Well, it seems to me that these two lines of argument are fairly distinct, in the sense that health, on the one hand, is much broader than just acquiring omega-3 fatty acids. Perhaps we don't need to go too much on about the fact that we spend our lives sitting down, and not only our diets are unbalanced, but the whole of our physical activity is imbalanced. So there are issues to do with mental health and to do with social processes, to do with the quality of our cities, of our environments, our housing. It cannot be solved simply and solely by getting tablets of omega-3 fatty acids. So it is really a catchy argument, clearly, the improvement of the diet, but it seems a bit narrow to my mind. But that's often the case with big agendas in science and technology. They seem to be running on very powerful, narrow arguments. The same happened for the prawn farming at the time. It was introduced immediately after the drop in productivity for the green revolution. So the prawn farming became the blue revolution, with the idea of bringing proteins onto the diet of people living in developing countries, as well as boosting the economy. What happened is the economy was boosted for some companies, but as we know, the gap between the rich and the poor has grown in the past 20 years, and the diet of people living in developing countries hasn't necessarily improved. So it's not just a matter of bringing the fish into the markets. It's very much a matter of structural issues to do with poverty and to do with how we become poorer and poorer, while other groups in society become richer and richer.
You mentioned earlier on, Laura, that you've research interests and interactive and participatory activities to do with, as you term it, socio-environmental issues. So I take it then, I can see it through some of the readings that you sent through, that you've a great interest in Indigenous people's experiences and opinions and indeed fights against some of these developments. And I'd be interested to hear a bit more about areas such as British Columbia, and then what we might, you mentioned about the market and the activities in Scotland, what should we be aware of in terms of what's happening in British Columbia, and what should we take cognizance of and educate our young people about in relation to those activities?
Yes, certainly one of the very interesting things when you start browsing the number of websites that are now covering issues of quality of life for indigenous populations. You really see that there is a clear issue of inequity with respect to the education system. Often children that are coming through with a background of the native First Nations populations tend to struggle at school. Their language, their knowledge, their symbols, their ways of relating with the environment are not being recognized by conventional schooling, even conventional science education. There's a really large amount of literature that talks about reintegrating indigenous knowledge within science education and more generally within school education. So issues of inequities at that level are actually reflected in inequities even in our schools. I mean, without going and talking about indigenous populations, we know very well how much schools are still very normatively selecting the middle class white pupils that can talk correctly with that accent, that have a background of professionals, that there's a particular way of approaching study or approaching life and work in general. So there is certainly an interesting parallel line there. Going back to the salmon aspects, again, when you start looking at the charts, the trajectories that the wild salmon makes throughout the world, really, you can really see that this fish is actually amazing. There are so many different types of species of salmon. They travel, as you know, for miles. They touch the waters in northern Canada and they arrive in Scotland and go back. It's absolutely fantastic what this fish is able to do. By means of this cycle that it has, it's possible to have a population of wild fish stocks in northern Colombia in a certain time of the year, and some other, and then we have wild stocks in Scotland other times of the year. So you can look at the salmon almost like a food materials that is diffused in the ecosystem. So it's not kept in a pen. It doesn't belong to anyone specifically, but it makes itself available. And of course, it's the top of the food chain is a big carnivore. It's fat, as we know, is full of rich nutrients. So when it dies, all these nutrients are again scattered across the food web and become available to other species at other levels in the ecosystem. So it's actually almost like a gift of nature, I would say. And when you start looking at it from this point of view, which is the perspective the First Nation populations have of the salmon as a king, as the ruler of the ecosystem, as something to be appreciated, to be blessed. It changes your perspective. It does make you scream when you think about keeping this very active, energetic fish enclosed in a pen, in a cage somewhere. I don't know whether that satisfies your question.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something I've been just trying to get my head around, is about the whole area of aquaculture feed or fish feed. And am I right in saying one of the arguments from the industry is that this a huge increase in fish supply is possible, and that indeed is the way it's played out in recent decades, and that's actually, there's been a massive increase in the amount of salmon available, and the price has actually decreased. But are some of the First Nation people arguing that, or some of the groups arguing that actually there's a net loss in fish supply because of the massive amounts of feed that's required for the likes of salmon farming?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, when we're talking about salmon farming, it's just like talking about intensive farming on land. I mean, it's an activity which is still heavily relying upon fossil fuels, some form of energy that obviously is required to make the feed, to process, to package. You need pumps to mix water, to oxygenate water in the cages. You need road systems, you need refrigerators. So it's a big industry. It's not just a bunch of salmons in the water that looks natural, apart from the metal fence that's built around them. So it is a really big question as to whether or not that kind of development can be sustained, particularly at this point in time where we are facing, obviously, the threat of climate change at the one end, and we are facing the threat of energy shortages with respect to fuel in particular at the other end. So listening to the voices of this nation population is not so much about, oh, we need to reject scientific agenda, or we must resist technological development, we have to go back to the things that were before. To me, it's not so much about that. To me, it's about considering that there might be other ways of doing things, that perhaps we can step back and ask some really serious questions, as you mentioned earlier, for example, about health. Some really serious questions about patterns of living, and perhaps deploy this huge investments that are made in GM research for other types of food alternatives or community development projects that have a more systemic impact on the communities, and therefore might give us more than GM, mm-hmm. Intensive GM farming can provide.
Now, we're just coming into the last couple of minutes of tonight's show, and I'll just remind listeners to the live show, you can come in with a late comment or question for Laura. You can email edutalker@hopemail.co.uk or pop something on Twitter with the hashtag edutalk. Couple of big questions for me to finish, so I appreciate we'll need to keep your answers brief. First of all, how would you go about, as somebody who's a lecturer within a school of education, you're teaching the next generation of teachers in our primary and secondary schools in Scotland, how would you suggest that we go about teaching around this topic?
As I said, it's important to develop strategies that encourage discussion, dialogue and participation. In my experience, I developed a number of these strategies, but the one I found most effective so far has been the role play. And I know it's not new, and in fact, it's not about the methodology itself, it's about the way it is used. So I generally study the issue, looking at different sources, trying to find the lines of debate, and work in collaboration quite often with a colleague, the drama department, to develop role profiles, role cards, so that the arguments are embedded in the perspectives of the characters. It's a really, really effective way because it tends to involve pupils and it stimulates their creativity, and debates really unfold. Now, the question is also to do with researching in and around decision-making processes, and a role play, being a simulation of a debate, allows for introducing different kinds of debate. So you can have a roundtable debate, or you can have a court of law type debate, or you can have an open debate, depending on how you want to set out the rules of the interaction. So it requires some research from the side of the teacher and the lecturers, and depending on the context in which one wishes to work. But it's something that it stays there. Once it's developed as a tool, you can update it over time as the issue that's been taken under consideration develops. So new cards can be created that bring in new lines of argument. And the children themselves can update or create their own role plays to discuss perhaps an issue that caught their attention in the news or heard about. So it's a very flexible tool that can, with time, can be transferred from the hands of the lecturers to the hands of the pupils themselves that can design their own simulations. If that helps.
Yeah, that's definitely something worth considering. I'll certainly look into that myself. And just finally, is there any interesting, I suppose, sort of activist movements out there that you think we should, people who are interested in this topic should find out more about? And also you'd mentioned the importance of the scientific community. Any interesting research that's ongoing at present or has been published recently?
Well, I published extensively on the prawn farming issue, and I'm currently writing an article on the GM salmon and the differences that it brings with respect to traditional intensive aquaculture. So if people are interested in following my research, they could link into my Twitter account or write to me. I usually have conference papers that are at an earlier stage of development, but it contain the main points of my reflections. So I'm happy to share with people. So if they want to contact me, I'm easily found in Google in the School of Education at Aberdeen, and my email address can be found, retrieved easily from there.
Okay, that's fantastic, Laura. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio EduTalk this evening. It's been fascinating listening to you talk around this subject, and best wishes for the future.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure, David.